Jackson, W266, DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Liberty Mutual Insurance.
I'm Wendy Gillette in New York. Police are searching for a suspect after a mass shooting at a ballroom dance studio late last night in Monterey Park near Los Angeles. Police say 10 people were killed and 10 others hurt.
1 minute it was a Lunar New Year celebration. Then in an instant it wasn't. Within minutes, police responded. LA County Sheriff Andrew Meyer.
When officers arrived on scene, they observed numerous individuals screaming.
This man lives nearby. He says he is in shock.
I know a lot of people in this neighborhood. This is right in our backyard. It's devastating.
Monterey Park has a large Asian population. The Lunar New Year festivities bring many people here. Right now, police say they have no motive. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Monterey Park, California.
Police say they're investigating another incident in the nearby city of Alhambra to see if it's connected. President Biden has been briefed on the shooting. The Justice Department took possession of more documents at the president's home. Correspondent Stephen Portnoy.
The attorney says federal investigators found 6 more documents with classified markings. We're told some of the papers date back to Mr. Biden's time as a senator, and that authorities also took handwritten notes dating to his time as vice president. Handwritten notes could be of concern to prosecutors if they contain sensitive government secrets.
Tens of thousands protested in the streets of Tel Aviv, angry about Israel's new far-right government. Law student Amit Melamad.
I can't believe that the changes they want to make will make such a difference. It's basically a change in the regime.
Last year's baby formula shortage has led to a federal investigation against a Michigan company. WWMT-TV anchor Ali Jennerjohn has more.
The Department of Justice is investigating Abbott Laboratories' infant formula plant in Sturgis. The plant was shut down for months last year after an FDA inspection found bacteria in several areas. Powdered infant formulas made at the plant were recalled, creating another hurdle for families struggling to get baby formula following supply chain issues.
A judge makes a ruling in a murder case against 2 paramedics, Allison Keyes reports.
An Illinois judge has ruled that 2 paramedics charged with first-degree murder and the death of a black man should stand trial. Prosecutors say the 2 strapped Earl Moore Jr. face down on a stretcher so tightly that he suffocated. Body cam video of the medical personnel caused an outcry. Moore had called 911 and the paramedics were told he was suffering from alcohol withdrawal. The video shows them slamming him forcefully onto a stretcher. The paramedics face up to 60 years in prison if convicted.
This is CBS News.
Nobody should have to pay for one-size-fits-all insurance coverage. Liberty Mutual customizes your car and home insurance so you only pay for what you need. Liberty Mutual
The Shaw 101 FM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The federal infrastructure law has been in effect for a year now. Community leaders around Wisconsin are optimistic about badly needed repairs and improvements. Here's Mike Moen.
At the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, Zach Brewing says so far nearly $3 billion in projects have been announced with funding from the law. Most are transportation related, and Brewing says it's badly needed as many areas have backlogs for priorities like road and bridge repairs.
And so by having a real strong federal partnership in the area of infrastructure helps address some of the backlog.
The law will also provide states funding for clean water infrastructure and expansion of high-speed internet. The plan did have some Republican opposition, but has otherwise been hailed by political analysts as a bipartisan achievement. Despite the significance of the law, some of those analysts say it hasn't stayed on the public's radar, especially during the recent election. But supporters are still getting the word out. Megan Rowe is with Opportunity Wisconsin, which has spent the last year educating communities about the benefits of these projects.
Whether we're spending less on car repairs due to updated roads and bridges, having access to safe drinking water or improved mass transit opportunities, this law is a once-in-a-generation investment in our state's infrastructure and competitiveness.
And as more projects are announced, Rowe says it means additional well-paid union jobs for distressed areas. She says the long-term benefits from various improvements should particularly help rural areas and underserved communities. An interactive online map from the White House shows the projects so far are spread fairly evenly across Wisconsin. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell.
It's a new year, and because we're excited about our new and still growing Civic Media network of radio stations, it's time to do something really big. How does $1 million advertising giveaway sound to you? Our celebration is your chance to work with Civic Media's amazing sales team, creating a radio advertising campaign promoting your business for free. Save the date. The $1 million advertising giveaway is only happening on Thursday, January 26th. Full details on our website, civicmedia.us/million.
The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM, Waukesha's only news talk station. You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is Jim Santel, and thank you once again for joining me on this Saturday morning here on Morning Cannolis. This, as always, is our weekend review of the important stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. I'm here with you in this 9 o'clock hour, also the 10 o'clock hour this morning, talking about all those significant news desserts of the week, including a number of both violent crime, white-collar crime, matters in and out of our courts this past week, lots and lots of things to get to on our ambitious but always achievable syllabus, hopefully informative and educating and also engaging for all of you. As always, this hour and next hour as well, my wonderful producer and I, Kelvin, are taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. That phone number once again, 844-967-2789. We're coming to you from the studios of WAUK Radio here in beautiful downtown Waukesha. It's 540 AM, 101 FM. Very much aware of the fact and welcoming listeners from around the state, the many, many different broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin. And in that connection, as all of us in Civic Media are announcing for the past several weeks, something big coming up this coming Thursday, January 26th. For advertisers, big and small and in between, $1 million advertising giveaway through Civic Media, the leadership, the direction, the oversight of the Civic Media being presenting this to potential advertisers, an opportunity for advertisers, businesses throughout the state of Wisconsin to come into and be a part of the Civic Media team, offering free advertising packages starting at $5,000, all of that being offered on Thursday, January 26th, just for that one day. Go on civicmedia.us/million. Find out more about that. Lots of great opportunities to be a part of something special. Get some free advertising in your particular area in the state. Also, lots of opportunities to craft that advertising to make certain that it supports and advances your particular interests. Once again, that $1 million giveaway this coming Thursday, January 26th, on all of the broadcast stations of Civic Media statewide. Again, thank you so much for joining me this morning on Weekend Cannolis. As I said, our agenda, our syllabus this morning is chock full of a variety of different things in and out of the courts, always focusing once again on law, government, and justice in America. Traditionally, at this point in our show, we begin with a retrospective. We look back at history to try to figure out what happened on this particular day in history. And sometimes I vary that, and this morning is following that particular process. We're not going to look back to things happening on this day, but something significant that happened in history tomorrow, 50 years ago tomorrow. And I suspect that many, if not all of you, know exactly what that is. That's right. It was 50 years ago tomorrow, January 22nd, 1973. 1973, that the United States Supreme Court, decision 7-2 majority, issued a decision named Roe versus Wade. It came in the wake of a series of cases affirming the privacy rights under the Constitution of the United States of America, a theory, a concept, a notion, a doctrine, a right that was established way back in 1965, a case called Griswold versus Connecticut, and that until last summer animated our sense of privacy rights across the board in many, many areas, including the right to marry, including the right to make decisions about medical treatment and even end-of-life care, decisions about who we are as a family, all those kinds of things, all of those privacy rights. 50 years ago tomorrow, Roe versus Wade decided by a 7-2 majority, finding under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution that there is indeed a privacy right inside the Constitution. Many of these kinds of things, not explicitly stated, but by virtue of what I'll call the penumbra, the kinds of things that emanate from the Constitution, privacy rights being one of them. Harry Blackmun was the justice of the Supreme Court that wrote the majority opinion at that time, issued on that day, in many ways a medical opinion, and at that time identifying the three different trimesters and identifying the increasing interests of the state in regulating abortion as the pregnancy goes forward. And again, for the most part, since that time, the focus has been on the first and to some extent second trimester. Ultimately, in 1992, a number of years after that, the Supreme Court basically abandoned that sort of rigid analysis for the three trimester approach that Blackmun and the other members of the Supreme Court had articulated back in 1973. In 1992, in a case basically said called Casey versus Planned Parenthood, basically reaffirmed that fundamental right, acknowledged that it can in fact be a somewhat of a sliding scale based upon medical capacity and the ability to maintain and keep a fetus alive outside of the womb, all those kinds of things. But Casey in particular said, not only do you have a right to an abortion in those first weeks, in those first months of a pregnancy, but also prohibited states, prohibited the federal government from imposing any undue burdens on that right, on that practice that was established in Roe versus Wade way back in 1973. Interestingly, Casey, like Roe, many years before that, was not a partisan decision. As I said, in many ways, if it is criticized to this day, it was regarded as somewhat of a medical analysis, again, abandoned somewhat over time because recognizing that medicine does indeed move forward and progress. But this affirmation, once again, coming from a bipartisan and apolitical, a nonpartisan Supreme Court. And the evidence of that is not only the 7-2 majority back in 1973, but the majority of the Supreme Court in 1992, including a major portion of that majority opinion in Casey, written by Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who continues to be a now resigned member, but still with us, doing some wonderful things out there in the area of civics and, importantly, promoting civics concepts across our nation. But she joined many others on both sides, if you will, of the political aisle and said, you know what, this is a right that is inherent in the Supreme Court, in the Constitution. The Supreme Court further saying you can't impose an undue burden on that right in Casey. And so 50 years ago tomorrow, that major case and the follow-up case in 1992 decided. And as we know well, back in the summer in June of 2022, the decision in Roe versus Wade and effectively Casey as well, wiped away by the decision of this present Supreme Court, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, finding that indeed the decision back in 1973, followed in 1992 in Casey, was wrongly decided, as Justice Alito wrote for the majority. Plainly some vigorous dissents. And if the court were to revisit this down the road, could certainly revisit those fundamental notions. But today, the lasting legacy of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, not yet a year old, two things. One is that we no longer recognize a constitutional right, a constitutional right inhering in privacy rights under the Constitution to abortion, sending this issue, as we all well know, back to the states, and states adopting various rules, regulations, policies, practices, doing it in different ways, some by referendums, some by legislative actions, many of them imposing all sorts of dramatic restrictions on the right to an abortion that never would have been passed muster under Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood. And the impact of that is today. Today, in January of 2023, we quite literally do have a patchwork of states, of jurisdictions out there that understand the right to an abortion in different ways, different applications of not only privacy rights, but also the practical implications for women, and I would also add men, when it comes to abortion and the decisions, all important decisions being made on that supremely private decision about one's own body. The other significant thing that came out of Dobbs, of course, is that it opened up this notion. The first time since Griswold, the first time certainly since Roe versus Wade and Casey, the Supreme Court began to carve away, to back off of this fundamental notion that each one of us has a privacy right. And as we know well, one of the Supreme Court justices wrote in a concurring opinion back in June that he feels strongly that we should visit some of the other privacy rights that have been acknowledged in the wake of Griswold, in the wake of Roe versus Wade. And that, too, is a matter for great concern of all Americans, as these other fundamental rights may also be subject to review and arguably rescission by a future term of the United States Supreme Court. We don't have a lot of cases on the docket of this Supreme Court that had readdressed privacy rights, but we do have some awfully important cases that are on this docket. And today, looking forward to tomorrow, we are thoughtful about the 50-year anniversary of Roe versus Wade, no longer the rule of law, the law in our nation, supplanted by Dobbs and perhaps other cases coming down the road. We know as well that during this term, the Supreme Court, as I just indicated, is addressing a great number of other kinds of cases that are out there. As of this morning, this term, the 2022-2023 term of the Supreme Court, has identified 52 different cases that it is going to be hearing. It has had oral arguments on many of them already, many of them involving things like religion and the interface of that with employment rights and the rights under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, a free speech case coming out of Colorado having to do with LGBT rights and the capacity of a state to impose restrictions, limitations that ensure that the rights of LGBT people in our nation are supported and affirmed. There's an environmental case involving the future of the Clean Water Act. There's a race case involving whether or not universities and colleges have the right to adopt and employ race as one among many factors in deciding about its entering classes. There's a copyright case involving, of all things, Andy Warhol and Prince. There's an interstate commerce case that impacts the capacity of states to make decisions about the labeling and the management of food products inside its own state. There's a case, very important case, involving how we're going to deal with our Native American children under the Indian Child Welfare Act. There's a huge immigration case having to do with the authority of the Secretary of Homeland Security to establish policies and practices for immigration. And there's a health care case involving the future of Medicaid, Medicare, and the capacity to sue when one has been the subject of mistreatment, medical mistreatment, maybe even abuse at a nursing home. And there's a significant case involving the internet, which we're going to get to in just a moment, talking about the significance of the internet in our time in 2023 and going forward. We're going to talk more about that internet case and also take your calls right as we continue this morning on Morning Cannolis.
This is Pat Greitlow from Up North News Radio. On the air, online, or on demand, make it a point to catch the first word on Wisconsin news, sports, and more weekday mornings from 6 to 8 all across the stations of the Civic Media Radio Network.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous Ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which is audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms.
Yeah.
We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. High temperatures reach up to 30 this afternoon under cloudy skies with a chance for scattered snow showers. Winds out of the north, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Lows dip down to about 20 tonight. Cloudy skies expected. Sunshine mixed with clouds at times tomorrow. High temperatures reach up to 33. A dusting of snow today. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 21 degrees.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Big Bend to Menominee Falls. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
We are back here in Morning Cannolis, and we are talking this morning in our first segments, again, about the United States Supreme Court, an issue, a topic, a very important part of our government that has a tremendous impact upon who we are as a nation in this 21st century. And right before we took some time off here and did some advertising here, we were beginning to talk about the important cases coming up. I want to highlight this morning a couple that are going to be argued in about a month from now, on February 21st and February 22nd. And I said right before the break that they have to do with the something called the Communications Decency Act, an act that was passed by the Congress way back in 1996. Fundamentally, although it's a much more complicated statute, the act provides for general immunity to internet platforms, internet providers, from liability for content that is posted or published by users of their services. So providing this immunity under the law, the Communications Decency Act, for those internet providers, for platforms that are provided to users of those services. And there are two cases, and both of them are raising the legitimacy, the rightness, the legality, if you will, of the application of this law to these particular facts of the case. Let me tell you a little bit about both of these cases, because they are significant. In November of 2015, many of us, if not all of us, recall the horror of the Paris terrorist attacks that took place. There was a U.S. citizen named Noemi Gonzalez. She was killed at one of those bistros in Paris in this terrorist attack that was committed by the Islamic State. Gonzalez's family then filed a lawsuit under something called the Anti-Terrorism Act in the United States District Court for the Northern District of California, one of the federal district courts here in the United States of America. And in that lawsuit, on behalf of their fallen, their slain member of their family, Noemi, the Gonzalez family said that videos on the YouTube platform aided the Islamic State's recruitment efforts, and specifically even recommended that videos through its user-targeting algorithms promoted what happened in November of 2015. The plaintiffs in that case asked the court, consider whether providers are still protected from liability under the Communications Decency Act through those algorithms when those algorithms target users and recommend other users' content to them. In other words, they are involved in some ways in promoting the very messaging that may result in some indoctrination. And ultimately, the theory of this case is resulting in the deaths of Noemi Gonzalez and plainly others in November of 2015. That's a case called Gonzalez versus Google. It's going to be argued before the United States Supreme Court in about a month from now, on February 21st of this year. There's a second much-related case. It's going to be argued the day after, on February 22nd. It's Twitter versus Tomna. And this particular case, again, same kind of predicate. The plaintiffs in this case are relatives of an individual named Naras Alassaf, who is a Jordanian citizen. They filed this lawsuit against internet service providers and the platforms Twitter and Google and Facebook. This one also in the U.S. District Court in California. They likewise alleging that the Bros providers aided and abetted ISIS's growth, its promotion, the transfer of its horrific messaging, as that group used those platforms for recruitment, messaging, threats, propaganda to terrorize civilians. And they asserted in this lawsuit that ISIS would not be what it is today without the free communications platforms that these companies, Twitter and Google and Facebook, provided. The complaint alleged that the providers were directly liable under the Anti-Terrorism Act and that they concealed their support effectively by virtue of the way in which they conducted business. Again, why is this significant? Well, the allegations are that in 2017, a fellow named Abdul Qadir Masharipov, who is affiliated with the organization of the Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL, shot and killed 39 people from a nightclub in Istanbul, including Naras Alassaf, who again was a Jordanian citizen. It's his relatives who brought this lawsuit challenging this notion that the platforms, Twitter, Google, Facebook, and others should be effectively immune from prosecution for supporting, if you will, the statements, the representations, the indoctrinations, the propaganda, the messaging placed on these public media outlets that effectively, according to the complaint, resulted in the terrorist activity and the horrific shootings that happened in 2017. The Supreme Court is going to take this up again in about a month from now, and ultimately probably in May or June of this year, tell us whether or not, whether there is continued liability for these companies, non-liability rather, for these companies, or whether the Communications Decency Act is, with respect to this interpretation, does not, in fact, protect them. So it's a fascinating legal issue. It's also an incredibly important issue, of course, for the future of the internet. An awful lot of testimony at the time of the passage of the law back in 1996 that said that this is the basis upon which the internet can be profitable. Lots of questions out there about whether or not that's a sufficient motivation for this kind of thing. And testing this theory about whether or not the things that are posted on the internet, whether there is responsibility for them by the very folks who provide the platforms for that messaging. Again, a fascinating intellectual issue and a very important legal issue. Supreme Court also going to tell us an awful lot about the future of the internet, if in fact it decides to wrestle with those issues. So again, many things coming up before the United States Supreme Court in the weeks and months ahead, anticipating that in June, May and June of this year, right on this broadcast and others, we're also going to be talking about those major decisions, including these involving Google, involving Twitter, involving Facebook and others. Again, as always, we appreciate so much your phone calls, your comments and your questions. And Dick, this morning, we're delighted to have you with us once again, calling in from Madison. Thanks for joining me, Dick.
It's a little off topic, James, but ever since Thursday, I've had a burning question after watching Ari Melber's show. He dedicated almost all of it to the Dominion situation with the Murdoch and Fox News, Sean Hannity, on and on and on. But it seems to me that even former Attorney General William Barr, I know he's twisted and turned the law pretty well himself, but when it really comes down to it, we know what he said about the election. Hannity's even admitted that it's all a bunch of BS, and yet Fox keeps going out there with the lie constantly. I just don't quite understand
right,
this.
Right, and Dick, not only do I appreciate your always thoughtful comments and identifying this, but we're also going to be chatting about that very issue.
WAUK 540 AM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News special report. A gunman is on the run after a mass shooting overnight following a big Lunar New Year celebration in Monterey Park near Los Angeles. Police say 10 people were killed and 10 others hurt. It happened at a ballroom dance studio. This man lives nearby.
I know a lot of people in this neighborhood. This is right in our backyard. It's devastating.
CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman is there.
This incident occurred at around 10 to 10:30 last night. A Lunar New Year celebration was taking place in Monterey Park, which has a very large Asian American population. That's when gunfire occurred.
Police say they do not yet have a motive for the shooting. They're investigating another incident in the nearby city of Alhambra to see if it's connected. President Biden has been briefed on the shooting. This is the fifth mass shooting in the U.S. this month. CBS News special report. I'm Wendy Gillette.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Max Inc. Radio, we are local music with Pete from the Skin Tones.
Here, you have been warned. Not only Madison, the rest of Wisconsin and the U.S., Skin Tones, we're coming at you. We're going to be committing rock atrocities. We're fit. We're in shape. We are tight. We are muscular. We are attractive for our ages. And we are sexy as hell.
Listen to Max Inc. Radio Saturday night, 6 p.m. to midnight on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. And we are now on the air in Waukesha. Live weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw. Turn on, tune in, and help us rebuild the American dream. Check out our website at TheRickSmithShow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m. always on the Civic Media app.
Governor Tony Evers, Tim Michaels said you had gone, quote, full woke. Dr. Jill Underlie said that somebody who says that has no idea what we're doing in schools to make sure kids feel safe.
We want to make sure all kids feel supported. Tim Michaels, we don't teach CRT in our schools. You got to come to the present century here, Tim, and be cognizant of what actually goes in the schools. My guess is you've never been in a public school in Wisconsin.
Up North News Radio with Pat Krylo airs at its new time from 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays across Civic Media.
We are joined by the 57th Assembly District Representative, Lee Snodgrass. Thanks for being here.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
How do I need to adapt this based on what has changed since I first introduced it? Government does not move fast. I'm sure that's a shocker to all of you guys. Public policy doesn't change until public opinion changes.
Listen to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on The Shaw, 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
Once again, this is Jim Santel talking with you this morning from the studios of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha, but extending to the Civic Media broadcast outlets throughout the state of Wisconsin. Thanks for joining me once again this morning. And right before the break, we were talking with Dick and raising an issue that he said was off topic. In fact, Dick, not off topic one bit. Among the 10 or so major issues in the news this past week, let's get to that right away since you raised it. Dominion versus Fox News. What is this lawsuit all about? Well, as Dick was indicating, people like Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, others in the lead up to and certainly following the election of 2020, advancing this theory that somehow it was the election machines themselves manufactured, provided two voting outlets by Dominion. Dominion is the name of the company that, because of those voting machines, the way that they're configured, the algorithms inside them, the software inside them, that skewed the election. And the election was stolen. The election was skewed as a result of those machines being responsible for not counting votes properly and giving the election to Joe Biden and not to Donald Trump. Well, it turns out, as Dick was saying, that that, of course, is completely unfounded. That theory is completely debunked, and it has been debunked. And Dominion not only decided to publicly refute and deny that its product had anything to do with any improper voting during 2020. There was none. And certainly the machines themselves, if anything, ensured the integrity, as Dominion says, of that 2020 election. But Fox News, even though it knew, based upon some of the discovery already produced, a lot of the emails, a lot of the internal memorandums, a lot of the things, communications inside, both the on-air talent and the other leadership, the producers of Fox News, knew for a long period of time that this allegation made about the corrupted Dominion voting machines was simply wrong, simply false, no support for it whatsoever. And of course, during the course of their lawsuit that they brought against Fox News for defamation, for saying this about them, knowing it to be wrong, during the course of this discovery, huge numbers of emails and those memorandums that I described, all of those kinds of things coming to light, even discovering more as the days go on and on. During the course of recent weeks and months, Dominion, by virtue of its filing this lawsuit, seeking $1.6 billion, billion with a B, from Fox News, has been able to take the depositions of many of the images, many of the people who were on the Fox News image as leaders of the programs on a daily basis, also the leadership, the producers behind the scenes, and that has included many of the people who are on those talk programs during the course of the day and the night. And just this past week, Rupert Murdoch, who is the owner and principal CEO, if you will, of Fox News, was deposed. 2 days of depositions about what he and his other supervisors and leaders of Fox News knew and didn't know. And again, confronted certainly with information that internal to Fox News for a long period of time, they knew that this story, this position that was being advanced on air by its on-air talent, was simply wrong. And so Rupert Murdoch, in addition to many other people, deposed this past week as a part of discovery. And I raised the issue, and Dick, appreciate your raising it because it was on our agenda this morning already. What's going to happen here, of course, is that will continue as part of discovery in a civil case like this, including defamation. The plaintiff, which is Dominion, has the right to explore what happened. Very much unlike criminal cases. You've got the right to depose people on the opposite side, get documents internal to the corporation. That's what Dominion is doing right now. And one of two things will happen. Either the case will go to trial, and all this information, presumably a lot of what, for example, Rupert Murdoch said this past week, a lot of the other on-air talent, the people, the other producers, that could also come out during the course of the trial. Or there could, of course, be a settlement, a monetary settlement, compensating Dominion for what it maintains with good cause was the defamation by Fox News of Dominion based upon all these repeated lies about the 2020 election, and in particular, this false notion that the Dominion machines were responsible in some way for an election that was stolen that wasn't anything of the sort. And so we'll continue to monitor that case. And again, Dick, appreciate very much your bringing that not off topic as well. Getting back and for one final story about our Supreme Court, also broke this past week. Again, in connection with the very first thing that we talked about at the top of our show this morning, the 9 o'clock hour here, and that is the decision back in June, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, to rescind, to revoke, to turn back Roe versus Wade, 50 years of privacy rights, abortion rights in America. You recall well that long prior to the issuance of that decision by the United States Supreme Court, there was a leak of a draft of that decision. Turned out that the draft was pretty much the same as the ultimate decision issued by the Supreme Court, the majority of the Supreme Court, authored by Sam Alito, one of the associate justices of the Supreme Court. And in the wake of that, a couple of things happened. One is there was fairly round the table, if you will, Supreme Court justices condemning this leak, this early release. Even those who were opposed to the decision as it was coming out, those who were in favor of it, who had written it, shocked, horrified by the fact that there had been this horrible breach of protocol, breach of rules and regulations inside the Supreme Court. Again, virtually unprecedented when it comes to the release of an opinion like this. And so the Supreme Court Chief Justice, his name is John Roberts, as you know, not only condemned whoever it was who released this draft early, but also said that he was going to conduct an investigation of where this, while this happened, who was responsible. And just this past week, the Supreme Court, through John Roberts, the clerk of court and others, announced just on Thursday, a couple of days ago, that this internal investigation, believe it or not, had failed to identify who leaked that draft of the opinion that's overturning Roe versus Wade in the Dobbs case. This, again, 1973 decision overturned in 2022. A 20-page report. It was issued by the court's marshal. Her name is Gail Curley. And she says she oversaw this inquiry, said that the investigators had conducted 126 formal interviews of 97 employees, each one of whom had denied being the source of the leak, everyone denying that they were the one who leaked this particular draft order. Several employees significantly, honestly, acknowledged that they had told their spouses or their partners about the draft opinion and the vote count in violation of the court's confidentiality rules. So that came out during the course of this investigation. But again, every single person talked to denied any involvement in this at all. The investigation, according to Gail Curley, again, the court's marshal, did not determine that any of those discussions led to a copy of the draft opinion becoming public. Investigators found no forensic evidence of who may have leaked the opinion in examining the court's computer devices, its networks, its printers, its available call and text logs, all this coming from the language of that report. And so the answer, apparently, while the court's marshal said they'll continue to investigate, continue to pursue leads, is that the court has accepted, apparently, this notion that we'll never find out who actually leaked this. And a couple of observations about this. I should indicate as well, but along the way, that in addition to the nine justices, and Gail Curley clarified just yesterday that she had a number of conversations with the Supreme Court justices themselves, absolutely necessary as a part of this investigation, apparently not placed under oath, not required to swear off on any affidavits, which was what the way that many of the other employees of the Supreme Court were handled. But there were discussions among those Supreme Court justices, and Gail Curley indicating just yesterday that none of those discussions led to any information that led to believe that any of the sitting Supreme Court justices or their spouses may have been involved in that leak. Beyond that, the investigation that in addition to the nine justices, 82 law clerks, prone employees of the court, had access to electronic or hard copies of the draft opinion. But once again, no indication based upon this report and the investigation conducted by the court's marshal that we know who actually did this. Michael Chertoff, who is a former Secretary of Homeland Security, also very famously inside the Department of Justice for many years in many leadership positions, reviewed this and independently assessed the investigation, said in a one-page statement that accompanied this report just released this past week that Curley's team had conducted a thorough investigation, he said. He could identify any additional useful investigative measures that could have been taken. Now, a couple of observations about this. Number one, initially, when this was identified, no crime here, no crime committed in releasing this, in leaking this particular draft opinion. Hard to identify exactly what a federal or even state crime could be. And so we're not talking as a predicate about any underlying criminal activity yet. And so we're not pursuing a criminal investigation. However, and this is where an awful lot of people, including me, finds some great concern about this lack of being able to identify who did this. Is there an interest in finding out who this is? Absolutely. Not because there's a criminal prosecution coming up, but nonetheless because the integrity of the court is all important, as we have discussed on this broadcast in many, many circumstances. John Roberts and others on both sides of the political aisle have condemned this, and it would be appropriate not only to terminate the employment of that person who did this, but also to send the law a strong deterrent message that these kinds of things are not helpful, just the opposite when it comes to the proper conduct of the court. And so, in referring this matter to the court's marshal and conducting this investigation as it was done, the Chief Justice plainly did not take advantage of something that could have been done. If he had reached out to the Attorney General and said, you know what, even though there's not a crime here, we would like you to bring in your qualified investigators who do this kind of work all the time, forensics investigations not only of the technology of the electronics here, but also of the human aspects of this. Who did what when? This kind of investigation done all the time by, yes, that's right, the FBI and other federal agencies. Wonder out loud why it is that there was not this referral made, again, upon the permission of the Attorney General, recognizing the FBI does not traditionally do non-criminal investigations, but they're the experts out there, and there are people inside government who I believe could have come to a conclusion based upon the good work that they do in many, many other cases. And the other observation that I would offer about this is just this, and that is that now that this investigation seems to have come to a conclusion, we know that the universe of people not only described in the report, this 82 or so law clerks or other employees, including or perhaps not including members of the Supreme Court themselves, the justices, about 100 people altogether who might have had access to this report. One of those people, at least one of those people we know, leaked this report. And so if there have in fact been interviews conducted of all of these individuals as a result of the findings, resulting in the findings that Gail Curley announced this past week, what else do we know? We know that one of them, at least one of them, did commit a crime in making false statements, either under oath, perhaps not under oath, making false statements to a federal investigator, a federal agent on a material, significant investigation like this. That is a crime. And so we now know that there is an employee of the United States Supreme Court who committed a crime in the very investigation of this matter that regrettably not done in a way that resulted in a finding here. The American people need to know better. They need to know, as does the Supreme Court itself, that the integrity of the court is intact. Whoever did this employee needs to be terminated, and the rule, the deterrent value of that investigation needs to be advanced not only for present employees, but for all future employees who might think of doing this down the road. So that's my commentary this morning about that major news also coming out of the United States Supreme Court. In addition, as it continues in the weeks and months ahead to prepare more drafts, and they're underway right now before the United States Supreme Court. They're being exchanged as they were a year ago at this time in connection with Dobbs. All those other cases we've talked about, those cases are now the subject of drafts being exchanged among the Supreme Court justices. We'll see the final drafts, final versions of those, after the drafts in May or June. We're going to talk more, of course, about all of that and about many, many other cases pending in our courts as we continue our discussion this morning on Morning Cannolis. Stay with us for that discussion and always taking your phone calls, as before, at 844-967-2789.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
What is dedication?
I think a parent's job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Chance for scattered snow showers this afternoon. Otherwise, cloudy skies expected. Daytime highs approaching 30. Winds out of the north, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Lows dip down to about 20 tonight. Cloudy skies expected. Sunshine mixed with clouds at times tomorrow. High temperatures reach up to 33. A dusting of snow today. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 23 degrees.
The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Welcome back to Morning Cannolis. We're talking again this morning, as we always do on Saturday mornings, about these major issues in law, government, and the aspiration for justice in America. A couple more things going on in the courts of America just this past week. One, an evidence matter. We have talked on this broadcast in the past about these trials in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia against groups of people, including especially the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. These are these nationalist, white supremacist, anti-government groups that were also involved in coordinating, in many ways, the January 6th assault on our Capitol, the attack upon our democracy. We talked in the past about the trial of Stuart Rhodes and some of his colleagues, the convictions of them on many counts for seditious conspiracy. This past week, the continuing trial against a fellow named Enrico Tarrio and some of his co-defendants. They're the head of the Proud Boys. That also going on in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. We talked last week about the fact that the judge, the presiding judge in that case, would permit in the Proud Boys criminal prosecution for seditious conspiracy the tape of the now former president, Donald Trump, during the course of the debates of 2020, sending a message to the Proud Boys and perhaps others saying, stand back, stand by, videotape of that in the debate with Joe Biden, a message to the Proud Boys. The judge finding that that did, in fact, affect the Proud Boys, especially with the response given by Enrique Tarrio, which acknowledged that and indicated that, indeed, the Proud Boys would, in the president's own words, stand back, stand by until called upon him to come forward. Well, this past week, another evidentiary ruling, which is significant not only in terms of the trial going forward, but also shows you what happens during the course of these criminal prosecutions and the ways in which judges do, in fact, make decisions in all directions based upon the significance of the evidence and the evidence rules, the federal evidence rules, presented this past week for consideration by the jury, but the judge said no, was a video clip of a reported, not just reported, but confirmed meeting between the leadership of the Oath Keepers, again, Stuart Rhodes and his folks, and Enrique Tarrio and the Proud Boys, one day before January 6th, kind of the first information indicating that there was a connection between these two major groups responsible for a huge amount of violence and potential violence on January 6th. A video clip showing them getting together, showing this film clip of someone saying, this is happening, this is inevitable, we need to do this fast, all of this is going to be inevitable. Well, the judge this past week said, you know what? I'm finding that particular video clip, That video is not going to be presented to the jury. So we know about it by virtue of the fact it's in the public domain. But the jury is getting instructed not to watch the media about this, will not see that. Again, focusing upon this notion that judges do, in fact, make thoughtful decisions based upon the rights not only of all of us to a fair and decent trial on behalf of the state, but also the rights of the defendant to have a fair and decent trial. That done just this past week in the U.S. District Court. We'll continue to monitor what happens in that Proud Boys trial as that goes forward, likely once again resulting in a criminal conviction of this fellow Enrique Tarrio and others. More of those kinds of seditious conspiracy trials also coming up in 2023 in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia, in addition to nearly 1,000 people now having been charged for their actual involvement in the riot, the attack on the Capitol of January 6th. Before we go on to other news stories, we're going to take some callers, which we appreciate tremendously. Jean from Eau Claire, thanks so much for calling in, Jean. Glad to have you with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I hate to interrupt your flow, but I wanted to go back to the Supreme Court justices.
Yes.
You know, wasn't there kind of investigations or inquiries regarding certain religious entities or groups that had access, you know, to the Supreme Court justices, particularly Alito, having some office nearby and in there a lot, and may have had some, you know, influences over some of their decisions? They're trying to figure that out. I don't know. I had seen a hearing, I don't remember if it's the House or Senate, where there was a witness, and of course they beat up that witness that was a member of this group, you know, that helped pay for, different kinds of outings and stuff like that. I don't know if you've heard any of that, or is that just conspiracy? And then Judge Thomas saying this was the reason. This was the reason there's so much suspicion of the Supreme Court. Thomas was saying that, and I was thinking when I watch it, give me a break, Mr. Thomas. We know why we don't trust the Supreme Court. Anyway, thank you very much. I don't know if you can comment on that or not. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Jean, again, glad to have you with us this morning and raising some issues. This issue, regardless of whether it is the focus of the media, and the media has raised this issue, Jean, indicating, gosh, are there inappropriate influences on our Supreme Court justices? Yes, there has been some testimony in the halls of Congress about this as well. Lots of discussion about the extent to which there are groups out there who are having inappropriate contact with the Supreme Court. Now, we know well that you can have an awful lot of impact upon the decision-making authority through proper processes, right? And we've talked in this broadcast about, for example, the involvement of lawyers, not only for the parties, but also what are called amicus or amici, who are friends of the court. If I've got an interest, for example, in this Google case I talked about earlier, I've got an interest in any of the other matters, the Clean Water Act case we're talking about, the religion case, the free speech case, I can seek permission to petition the court for the submission of a brief that describes my particular interest, even if I'm not a formal party to the case. And that's a way of communicating to the judges, the justices, publicly, overtly. And that is entirely appropriate. Why? Because it's transparent, right? It's in the public domain. That happens all the time. Beyond that, plainly, the Supreme Court justices talk among themselves, rely upon their law clerks to have those kinds of discussions too. All of that very, very appropriate. What is inappropriate, and what the point of, I think, your principal issue is just about this notion that there shouldn't be a back channel access to the justices. Their views, again, do not have to be released until those opinions are made public. But there shouldn't be private groups that have access in some ways. Shouldn't be when the justices go out in the public. They shouldn't be having discussions, certainly, about what they're deciding. There shouldn't be any special avenues for private individuals to come in and talk to the justices about issues before them. When they do that, our system is compromised. And when, in fact, they do have connections with those outside groups, they should recuse themselves because their decision-making process might be subject to criticism by virtue of being tainted. And so, very important point to be focused on in the future as we hear down the road more of our decisions coming from the Supreme Court. Stay with us for our second hour here on Morning Cannolis as we continue to talk about the major issues in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
My fine guest, Maggie Dawn, attorney at law. I thought that the laws of the United States were supposed to evolve with societal norms. The vast majority of Americans, 70% approximately, believe that Roe v. Wade should be the law of the land. So that seems exactly contrary to the way the courts are supposed to evolve with our nation.
I'll just say this. The guy in Colorado can't be forced to make a gay wedding cake, but I can be forced to make a baby. I don't know about you, but that makes no damn sense to me.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter.
Dad, I picked up your pills, made your lunch, and your laundry is done.
When you care for a loved one, you take care of everything. But are you taking care of yourself? Find free care guides at AARP.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.